the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, you're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Dr. Stephanie Van Dellen is a fall 2024 addition to the SBA as she joins the management discipline. With a background in leadership, she is passionate about effective teaching, and her research interests include improving workplaces through the use of technology and leadership.
Dr. Van Dellen, welcome to the G Suite. Great to have you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Great to be here.
Yeah, and really excited to have you on faculty this year and beyond, for that matter. Just by way of background, you just joined us in Jepson.
Yep.
And let's talk about you today.
Okay. Yeah.
So, welcome. And tell me a little bit about, first of all, let's kind of give the background, some of your teaching and research interests.
Sure. So at my previous institution, I taught mostly organizational behavior and then topics in human resources, including staffing, compensation and benefits. And so here I'm teaching Management 350 mostly at the moment, which is a fun class because it's not just principles of management. It's a little bit of organizational behavior and a little bit of HR and a little bit of strategy. So kind of all the things I've done rolled into one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. And then prior to joining us, what were you doing?
I worked at Purdue Fort Wayne. It's a regional campus for Purdue in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I had 2 years there post PhD on a non-tenure track line called visiting.
Yeah.
And then I did 3 years on the tenure track. So I got converted and was able to start making some progress on that.
Awesome. And then you were like, if I could just get to Spokane, Washington. My dreams would be fulfilled. So, and full disclosure for the people listening, Stephanie and I are kind of neighbors, a couple blocks away.
Yeah.
So she's got good instincts on neighborhoods. Maybe bad instincts on neighborhoods.
I was going to say, I really love our neighborhood, but I don't like the skunks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's new this year.
I feel like someone should have warned me about the skunks.
Yeah. Do you get a lot of turkeys up by your house?
Yes.
Now? It's crazy. Now, I read this on the internet, so it must be true. What is true is I would say 10 years ago, there was not a turkey problem. They started showing up.
Mm-hmm.
But I had read on the interwebs that there was a native turkey in this area that was largely extinct, I think. And so they transplanted those from Appalachia like 30 years ago in the mountains. And now they're just blowing up everywhere.
This was done on purpose?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah. I mean, it's literally like, do they have any predators? I mean, apparently not. So, and I do know that Fish and Wildlife does things in our neighborhood to limit their, something like they find the nests and put like vegetable oil on the eggs and they don't develop or mature.
Oh.
That also on the interwebs, so okay. It could be totally made up, but yeah.
I did try to look up the turkeys and try to figure something out about it and why they're in the neighborhood. And I found this article and there's a picture of my house with a turkey in front of it.
That is right. I remember that.
Yeah. And I was looking at it. I was like, that looks like my house. And then I looked under the caption. I was like, that is my house. Like,
yeah. I think I might have a quote in that article in the spokesman. Did you read the article?
A while ago. This is when I first moved here a few months ago.
Yeah, they came down our block.
And, yeah.
Yeah, that was craziness. That's kind of when they were first on the scene. But anyway, I digress. Yeah. Okay, so take me back to the beginning. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the greater Los Angeles area.
Okay.
So Burbank until I was 7, and then we moved to Agoura Hills.
Okay.
And then my parents later moved to Westlake Village when I went to college.
Okay. Best airport in the world. Could be Burbank. Maybe not. Maybe John Wayne.
They're both very similar.
Up there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Convenient.
Yeah. Yeah.
To get you to a metro area. Or maybe it's just the fact that I compare them to LAX every time, which is the worst airport next to the old LaGuardia.
Yeah. LAX is a fun one because whenever you're actually prepared, you're like, I'm here 3 hours early so that I can wait in line at TSA for an hour. You get through in like 10 minutes. Yeah. Now what am I supposed to do with my time?
Yeah.
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 I know. And it's when you're short on time that
you get
devastated. You get stuck. Yeah.
I mean, even TSA pre on those big airports isn't that great of a I mean, it's still great. I fully promote it, but
yeah.
I'm almost like, I need to get Clear or Global Entry or like the next best thing. I'll pay for it because I'm just like the super stressed out person that can't handle it. But I do agree. They do a good job. So,
well, Global Entry gets you into the country.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I have that one.
Yeah. I'm going to Florence in the spring, so I'm going to need that.
Yeah.
The last thing I need after that is just an EU passport, and I'm set. So
watch out, world.
I'm kidding. LA. Okay. So LA growing up.
Yeah.
And then where did you go to undergrad?
University of Oregon.
Okay.
Yeah.
And up north.
Yeah.
Okay. A little Pac Northwest Duck fan.
Yeah.
They didn't do so solid last weekend in football. They won.
They still won. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They got the W.
Yeah.
But there's some, and they still have their coach. So that's good. That's a good thing. Do you still follow the Ducks?
I do. I will say that, it was Sunday this last week and I went, oh, when did the Ducks play? I bet it was yesterday. And then I looked it up. So I'm a little behind with probably just like starting a new job and having other things to worry about, but I will get back on it. Definitely start watching again and hopefully wrangle some of the college friends to go to a game.
Yeah. There's certainly a lot of Ducks in the building with Herzog and Hendrickson and Johnson and most of the Economists, I feel like, are Ducks.
Fun.
I don't have the stamina for football anymore. It's just too long.
Yeah.
You know, just to kill 4 hours. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm not like a big fan of massive, massive groups, but I feel like when you go to something like that, you're mentally prepared and you're like, yeah, I'm just going to stand around and everyone's going to be in my space and I'm not going to be able to hear after I walk out of there.
I am 100% on board with not a fan of the massive groups.
Yeah.
For sure. It stresses me out. Okay, cool. So Oregon.
Yep.
And then what was the next step after that, after college?
I was a boomerang millennial, went back to LA with the parents.
Yes.
And I worked for Dole Foods for a little bit in accounting.
Okay.
I would not have hired me to do accounting.
I could sense greatness when you must have been it.
I mean, it was like bookkeeping, like I could easily do it, but it wasn't where I wanted to be. I had graduated in 2010. So it's still, you know, the recession and everyone was underemployed and I'd taken one class in human resources and that was not enough to get me a job.
What was your undergrad? What did you study under?
It was business.
Just business. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Business marketing.
Okay.
Yeah. I've been a little flighty in my career. I guess you could see that.
You got to chart your journey. Yeah.
Yeah. I did work for a promotional products company. They did a lot of logo slapping. I did an internship. So that was as close as I got to marketing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's cool.
Yeah.
And then when do we get the HR itch or when are we thinking about HR?
Yeah. So I had studied abroad as an undergrad at the Copenhagen Business School.
Okay.
And I loved it.
Okay.
I had such a great time there.
Okay.
I don't know if I could have really located Denmark on a map prior to choosing to go there. But at the University of Oregon, they have an international requirement for their business students. So there's three ways you can complete that international requirement.
Okay.
You can go abroad. You can take a second year of a language, which I am not the best at languages. So that was not ideal for me. And then you could take three classes about a country. And I thought, oh, I'll take three classes about Greece because I was really into Greece at some point. I think I had traveled there at 18 with my mom prior to going to college. And I thought, that's what I'm going to study. And just realizing, well, why wouldn't I go abroad somewhere? There were three big programs they would promote in the business school because they had classes that would directly transfer back. Okay. One was in China. One was in Italy, but the Italian one was on the semester and we were on the quarter.
Okay.
So if you went in spring, you would lose some time.
Right.
And so my parents were very concerned that I would not be wasting time and it would not be slowing me down. And it was already more expensive. So I was like, where can I go over the summer? And that was the Copenhagen Business School.
Okay.
So I had a great time. And I thought, well, you know, to circle back to where you were going, when did I decide to kind of go back and get more degrees? I thought, well, here I am doing accounting, kind of light bookkeeping, and it wasn't really where I wanted to be. And I wanted to run away to Europe again and live some kind of vagabond existence.
Yeah.
But that wasn't really something in the cards for my family. I had friends that were doing that. And so I needed to do something purposeful. So I decided maybe I could get a master's degree abroad in something HR related. And I had a friend who was looking at a lot of programs because she didn't study abroad, but she had wanted to have that experience.
Yeah.
And so she was telling me about all these English speaking programs. And I was looking at MBAs in the LA area and other places and thinking, I don't want to take accounting and finance and econ again to take two, maybe three classes in HR. Right. So I thought, okay, let's do like a specialized master's. This sounds fun. So I got into the University of Manchester in England.
Okay.
And that's where I did my master's degree in organizational change and development, or OCD for short. That was fun. Yeah. We took all the same classes with the HRM and the HRD student. They're just slightly different programs, but I really enjoyed my time there. And then I thought, well, what's next? I had friends that were moving on to do PhDs. And again, I remember having a conversation very early on with a friend in my master's program who was like, you're going to get a PhD, right? And I was like, no, no, no. I'm just here to like have a reason to travel around Europe. Totally. And, yeah. And so that when I come back to the States, I'm employable in HR. And I think my time there, because the education system was so different, was what eventually drew me back into academia, because classes would have one deliverable. Usually you get five prompts, you'd pick for or against something, you'd write up a literature review, you'd use the literature to argue for your side, and that was the deliverable for the class.
Wow.
And the whole grade, which is a little scary. Plus their grading system is very different than ours. They really only go up to about 80. So when you get that 76, you're like, you know, and that's like getting an A. So.
And is that typical in the UK?
Yeah.
Is it typical in the Commonwealth that they do something like that?
I don't know specifically, but I do know. I think so.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Denmark had a really fun system. I think you could get a 13, a 12, a 10, a 7, a 4, a 2, a 0, or a negative 2 in the class.
And you had like so many points to graduate?
No, it was just like the points would average and that would be your GPA. So I think in one class I got a 10 and one I got a 12, and that transferred back as like an A and a B plus. But the negative 2, you'd have to basically like submit a blank exam and write something terrible to your professor.
Yeah, you have to try.
Wow. So, and I know you could resit for exams there too, which I thought was really interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, very, very interesting.
Yeah. So I think the difference in the educational system, I thought, well, you know what? I actually really like learning and I want to think about thinking all the time. And I've always liked teaching. I did a lot of TA work. So.
Okay. So you did some, teaching.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the fire was lit.
Yeah, except, you know, again, here I am like wandering around all these different careers. And I thought, well, I better actually go back and do some HR stuff since that's what was my intention.
The focus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So I moved to San Francisco. I had some friends there from undergrad and I thought, what a cool city. It's not overwhelmingly big like London or New York, but it's got all the great things of a big city. And so I took all these different jobs where I would help a company staff up for 6 months and then they couldn't afford me, need me anymore. And then I'd go on to the next one. So it was really fun in my early 20s.
Yeah.
I loved living there. And then I got to a point where I thought, ooh, rent is really killing me.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I either need to move out of the city or move on to my next thing. And I thought that was good timing to go get a PhD.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, San Francisco, I think, is unto its own a uniqueness. And I've probably said this before, but there was a playwright, I'm going to say Arthur Miller, but I could be way off. Mm-hmm. There are three cities in America, New York, New Orleans, and San Francisco. Everywhere else is just Cleveland. And there's some truth to that. I mean, it's, you know, it's, so you're in like a mini Cleveland in Spokane. But Spokane has its charms, but yeah, it's a pretty amazing place, but
yeah,
so crazy expensive. I mean, what I'm hearing, they're paying our graduates, you know, close to six figures coming out and they're still in the poorhouse if you're working in the city. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. So, I think when I was there in 2012, around 2012, 2014, I had started running my apartment for $1,800 and it was a 500 square foot, fourth floor, beautiful bay window. I had like a little sleeping nook and a great walk-in closet. And so it was, yeah, $1,800 when I first moved in there. And then they were running it 2 years later for $2,600. And wow. That was, you know, over 10 years ago. So yeah.
Craziness.
You definitely need a six-figure salary to afford anything.
Yeah.
and probably even with a roommate. Yeah,
and luckily, I mean, I think we have a fair amount of students that are from that area.
Yeah.
They'll commute in on BART. What classes did you teach in Manchester? Do you remember?
I didn't teach any classes there. When I was at University of Oregon, they had a program through first year programs that was supposed to help with the retention from year one to year two. Because there were so many big classes that were impacted, they kind of enticed the first year students to sign up for a FIG, a freshman interest group, that would get you seats in two impacted classes at a good time. And then you'd have to take a one credit College Connections course that was taught by a faculty member and then a teaching assistant who was an undergraduate student who had been through it before. Okay. So it was a lot of social skills, making sure that you made friends. The classes I think that my FIGs were typically in was an intro to business that was 180 people and an intro psych course that was 500 people.
Wow.
So taking a, you know, one credit, once a week, 50 minute class with the same 25 people and at least having some people that you recognized in that class, I think was very helpful. And there was a lot of study skills. And again, just trying to make sure you make it through your first years and you have a positive experience, so you come back. So, so I was in one freshman year, and then the subsequent 3 years after that, I was a teaching assistant for that. So that was probably my first like TA kind of experience, but I did a lot of tutoring as a high school student.
Other kinds of things. I feel like most everyone, or I'll say everyone, some people haven't brought it out yet, have that inclination to mentor and teach on some level, coach, what have you, you know, the next generation.
Yeah.
So
my mom was an elementary school teacher and a curriculum specialist. So I think that's where it comes from.
Awesome. Okay. So you're coming out of San Francisco and you're like, I'm going to get a PhD.
Yeah.
And I believe you went south at that point from San Francisco, right?
I did. I went to University of San Diego.
USD.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's known that I'm a big Padres fan, and they got a chance this year.
They're in the fight.
We'll say that at this point. So, which is good for the Padres.
I see your logo.
Yeah. Those are my teams up there.
Okay.
It's random. I didn't want to be a Dodgers fan growing up.
Well, I lived in LA, so that was my team.
Yeah, it was like, Dodgers or Yankees, you know, you don't want to be one of those people, and the Mariners were never really that good. I mean, they had some good years, but just trying to be different, and Tony Gwynn, Fred McGriff, Padres are it. I digress. You're down in San Diego.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey.
And you're pursuing a PhD. HR.
And leadership studies.
Leadership studies, okay.
Yeah, that's what my degree is in.
Okay, go on. So talk about that experience a little bit here.
Yeah, it was really fun, interesting, challenging. I think when people ask me, like, you know, would you do it again? I'm like, well, it was my admission into the club. So yeah, I guess I would.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of work. And especially with leadership studies, I think there's a lot of growth and development around who you are as an educator and how you lead and how you show up. And so that's a lot of work that can be tough psychologically, maybe. So we take like adult development courses and adaptive leadership courses. And then I did some research while there, of course, and I taught some classes in the leadership minor. But I loved San Diego. I lived in Little Italy. It was such a fun neighborhood. Awesome.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I studied abroad in Florence, and there was it was called Acqua al Due. There was a restaurant in Florence, and the owner spent half the year in San Diego at an Acqua al Due. I don't know if it was still there. It's been some time since I've been to San Diego, probably like 5 or 6 years, but the whole Little Italy scene is pretty awesome there. So
yeah, it was really fun culturally. I think both when I lived in San Diego and in San Francisco, I was in neighborhoods that would have big festivals and lots of music and fun things to do and all that walkability.
Yeah. Super awesome. Fun fact, the Caesar salad was invented in Tijuana, but it was a San Diego restaurateur that he had to open up a spot in Tijuana during Prohibition. So people would go down there to get their cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you knew that. I don't know.
I knew part of that story. Yes. I just knew it was something about San Diego.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Where all good things come from. Very cool.
Okay. So then, and then you taught at USD for a little bit.
Yeah, I taught a couple classes when I was in my PhD in the leadership minor. And I think the first one I taught was very useful because it was, once again, kind of a first year course, and they taught it, multiple sections of it. And we taught with a teaching assistant who was a student. So now I was on the opposite side of that, but now that I was the lead instructor. But they did the kind of train the trainer model. So for consistency amongst all the sessions, but also helping us learn how to teach certain activities. So that was probably the first time I learned to teach effectively, which I was very appreciative of because many of us just kind of get thrown into the fire when it comes to teaching.
100%. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. And I obviously don't have a PhD background, but shocked at how so many programs, they don't even care about it. It's just all about research, right?
Right.
And so you're kind of on your own. And I think as an outsider, not having gone through that process, I'm like, this kind of seems crazy, but I guess it is what it is.
Yeah.
And then when you graduated, did you go to the market? You went to Purdue Fort Wayne.
Yes.
And then to Gonzaga is where we're at.
Yes. Okay.
Good. I'm glad we got the story.
Okay.
What drew you to Gonzaga when you're making the decision of the next step?
Ooh, good question. I think part of that answer has to be like, why was I ready to move? And for me, when I first got my job at Purdue Fort Wayne, I didn't have any publications. So I had a little bit of a teaching record, which was great. And I started on that visiting track in fall 2019. And then the pandemic hit the next semester.
Yeah.
So I was very happy at how quickly they reappointed me. And then after that year, they put me on the tenure track, which was really nice.
Yeah.
But there was a couple things that kept happening when it came to people leaving and some of like my mentors and advocates and sponsors. And I thought, this is interesting. Like I'm still full steam, moving ahead and doing all the things, but I don't have some of those people that were my support system in Fort Wayne because I'm not from Indiana.
Right.
I don't have family there. I have family still in LA and then some in Texas and some times of the year, my parents are in Maine. So everywhere, but the Midwest. And I started to come back to this coast a lot for the friends from college who were getting married and having babies.
Right.
And I think there was a 6-month period that I made 5 trips to Seattle or Portland. And every time I had friends that would drop me at the airport and hug me and be like, why do you live in Indiana? And it was a really easy answer when I first got there. It was like, I'm so wanted and I'm appreciated and all this is so good. And there still was that, but now I had agency. Now I had publications. Now I had 5 years of a teaching record. And so I didn't have to be in Indiana anymore. And my friends and my social system and my support system was back on this coast. So that's what led me to start searching.
Yeah.
And then why Gonzaga? I guess I kind of knew you were hiring for this position prior to it being listed. I had a little insider knowledge from Dr. Bull Schaefer.
Sure.
I met her at MOBTS, the Management and Organizational Behavior Teaching Society, a couple years prior. We were at the Cal Poly one together, and she did this great talk about inter-rater reliability and an activity she uses in her classes. And I thought, wow, this is such a nice person, warm and welcoming. And I went to her session and she friended me on all the social medias afterwards. And we stayed in touch and I happened to be out here for something. And I thought, well, what's the harm in just reaching out? I haven't talked to her in like a year.
Let's
see if the worst thing she tells me is to kick rocks or something, you know, or doesn't respond. And that's not what happened at all. Becky invited me out for a meal and we had a great conversation. And she said, well, if you're looking, you know, we're going to be hiring.
Awesome.
So I knew about that at that point, but I was very intentional with my search to try to find a place that was going to be supportive of my continued development and the next kind of stages in my career, but also, you know, back on this coast. So I looked for teaching institutions, R2s, R3s. I don't publish at an R1 level at the Carnegie classification.
You do.
Yeah. So
me neither. Don't worry.
I publish good quality bee journals, you know, and I'm very proud of what I've done. But yeah, I kind of knew who I was and what I could offer. And so I specifically targeted institutions that I felt like there might be that person organization fit, that the values aligned between me and the organization. And I think that's one of the reasons. And I knew Becky, and Becky is just light, anybody who knows her listening. And I thought, wow, well, you know, I kind of want to be her at some point. Like, that feels just in her career and her personality and who she brings herself to, all her work that she does. And I thought, well, that's where she is. That's where I'm going to be embraced too.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So we're now, I guess it's the third week of class. We're in the third week of class.
Yeah.
Okay. How's it going? First impressions now that you're here full time? And
great. You know, I think I said to someone the other day, it's going surprisingly well. And they were like, they really honed in on that word surprisingly, because I had been told that Gonzaga students smell fresh blood and they attack like sharks.
Really?
Yeah. And I can't say that that's true from my experience, at least. It has been really positive. And so I was a little nervous. I was like, I'm an award-winning educator and, you know, they're going to attack me. And that's not at all what happened, at least not so far.
I'm glad to hear it. I guess, I mean, you're not fresh blood in the fact that you have a lot of teaching experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, my impression has always been they're pretty forgiving.
Yeah.
I mean, I would classify myself as maybe a slightly above average teacher, but I think that I convey to them that I care about their progress and I'll put in that effort. And they're super forgiving to me on a lot of things where, like, I know in this building, over half the people are better instructors than I am. I give myself a little grace because I teach tax.
Okay. So maybe they come into your class not super excited.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, well, they're voluntarily because they are accounting majors. But, and I'll remind them of that sometimes. We're here by choice. But that's interesting. Yeah. I mean, and I guess anywhere people that, you know, when you're nervous, people can sense that. And
yeah.
I think my first class, I was just like, just get through the syllabus. Just get through the syllabus. I think it took me like 45 minutes. I was like, wow. I think I have a beer or something like that. So
yeah, and I do think back to my first class that I taught at Purdue Fort Wayne. I had a group of girls that really, really didn't like me in this one class.
Oh, brutal.
And they would kind of mean girl me and say things under their breath, like, oh, here she goes again.
Oh my gosh.
Every time I'd ask them to get up and do an activity or something.
Oh, how respectful. Wow.
So, you know, maybe it triggered that with me that I was like, oh no. But no, everyone has been so nice and welcoming, and even, you know, all the colleagues too. Someone came up to me earlier today and told me how she just really loves having an office across the hall from me.
That's awesome.
And that I'm just a bright light to be around. And I thought, wow, that's so nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know who that is.
Yeah.
She's awesome too.
She's really wonderful. Yeah.
What do you hope as a teacher and a mentor and advisor, I should say, what kind of impact do you hope to have at your time at Gonzaga?
Ooh, that's a great question. I don't think I'm going to like change the world or revolutionize something, but I just hope that my small interactions with students and with others can create positive change or opportunities in their lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I look back on the teachers and or advisors in my life that had impact. And maybe even subconsciously try to model that on some level. Nothing about me is original. I'm just a big copycat.
I'm sure that's not the case.
Yeah. I would imagine you have a lot of good influences in your time. Any come to mind? Teachers, advisors, mentors?
Or yeah. The teacher that I worked with, the professor that I worked with when I was doing those freshman interest groups at University of Oregon, Michelle Henney, is one of my favorite people. She was also in accounting.
Okay.
So maybe another fellow fun accountant.
Wow.
And she was running the Girl Scout troop for her daughters, and she would bring in all these arts and crafts and really fun ways of doing an activity with a lot of different mediums. And so I think that's something I have carried through. I I want to say almost every class so far, I have brought like a bag of stuff with me for whatever activity we're going to do. I mean, I did eat a whole bunch of marshmallows last night that were left over from a marshmallow challenge.
Totally get it.
I told the students to eat them. I was like, please take the extras. And if you don't, I'm going to end up eating them. And that's exactly what happened. But so I think some of her enthusiasm and kindness and just creativity definitely rubbed off in that way.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What was the marshmallow challenge?
20 pieces of spaghetti, and then they have to build a freestanding tower.
Okay.
They get some rope and some tape, right? And they have to build the tallest tower.
Okay.
Business students apparently don't do very well on it. Kindergartners do really well because they kind of test and trial by error. And a lot of times the business students put the marshmallow on at the end and then it falls off when it's not supporting it. The weight of the marshmallow. But both classes did very, very well. I think we had about 8 teams each in each class, and at least half of them had a marshmallow that was supported by their tower. There are a few that got disqualified because they didn't abide by the rules of
that would have been me,
You know, taping it to the table or something. But it was really fun. We used it as a conversation about strategy, about what strategy did you have in trying to build this, if any, really.
That's fascinating. And was it a solitary assignment or was it like a group project or something on your own? Okay.
Yeah, groups of 4.
Okay.
Yeah.
I bet you hear some interesting conversations when you're walking around the class at that point.
It's fun to watch like one person kind of spring up as the leader and take charge. And occasionally there was someone who's like, I've done this before. I know how this works. Like, listen to me. And using kind of that expertise to assert authority.
Yeah.
And there were some that were really into it in ways that I hadn't. It's only week 3.
Right.
But you know, quieter students that haven't spoken, and then I hear them talking a whole lot in that smaller group or with that activity of trying to fiddle with something or figure it out or build something. So, yeah, it's fun to kind of see how I can bring out different personalities and engage students in different ways and how they may feel more ability to show up authentically.
Yeah, it's very different than my accounting experiences.
No, you're not making marshmallow towers.
No.
This is just management. We just play.
Well, it's so interesting because I've always said accountants are good at accounting and oftentimes not good at anything else.
You know? Yeah.
I think that can be reflected in I think the industry knows that when you look at the retention rates year over year at firms and things like that.
But all of our students have to take this Management 350 class.
True.
So even if they don't understand why they have to be in it, you know, hopefully they will soon enough.
Totally.
Yeah.
And we, at the grad level, we require now project management.
Oh, great.
And we strongly encourage team building. Becky's team building intensive. So I'm just like, we need these skill sets so much more, more and more every day. Kind of leveraging your leadership background, are there like categories of types of leadership or any kind of definition? And do you see that in the class and maybe elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. So there's not one true definition of leadership. I say there's one wrong definition of leadership, and that is to define leader and leadership as the same thing.
Okay.
Because leadership is a process that involves leaders, but also followers or constituents or the group, people, right?
Yeah.
And there's this mutual influence between both. And so obviously leadership is leader-centric, it's in the word, and the leader is quite important, but the follower, I think, and there's a lot of new push towards this over the last couple decades to focus on the follower and the power of the follower. But they do this, they engage in this process for some purpose, some shared goal or mission. And so that's kind of my definition, which is pretty similar to Peter Northouse and his definition. He has the best-selling textbook on leadership.
Okay.
So, there's multiple different kinds of leadership you can look at. Servant leadership, I think, is probably one that comes across on many college campuses and is probably very big here, too.
Yeah.
It's the work of Robert Greenleaf, was a Hoosier. So that went over really well when I was in Indiana.
Okay.
But he looked at leadership in his career at AT&T. He had started there with a math degree, and they said, we don't have any jobs for you. And he said, no, I'll take anything. And I guess he started digging holes for telephone posts, and then worked his way up through the company. And so through observations of what the best leaders did and taking kind of this action research approach, also what his father, how he led, a little bit of scripture. He was a Christian, and he really felt like the best leaders met the highest priority needs of their followers, and that kind of idea of leading from behind. So he had a best test for servant leadership, which said, do those who are served grow as persons? Do they become healthier, wiser, freer, more autonomous, and more likely themselves to become leaders? And what is the effect essentially on the least privileged in society? Do they benefit or at least not be further deprived? So there's this twofold of that, that you have to be doing something good for society, but also good for the individual and empowering them at the same time. So that's one theory. There's tons out there. Some people like toxic leadership, if you want to play in like the dark space of what not to do, maybe, is a complete juxtapose of that. Some leadership scholars will say, in order to be engaging in leadership, you have to be doing good. Whereas others will say leadership is a neutral term. And, you know, thus you can have things like toxic leadership. Followership's really big. There's a lot of stuff on transformational and transactional leadership. And that really started with James McGregor Burns. He's kind of considered the founder of like modern day leadership theory. He was an academic. He went to the psychologist in the psychology department, said, teach me about leadership. Because prior he was a historian, and he looked at what made great political leaders and really great men leaders. And he would write these biographies about them. So he thought, well, how do we train this and teach this? So that's a lot of where like modern leadership theory comes from, is how can this be learned and developed, and what behaviors can be taught? And yeah, that was probably a whole tangent on a bunch of different things.
No, that was awesome. That was fascinating. And as you were defining servant leadership, it actually made me think of some of my goals as a parent, my boys, not all encompassing, but that's fascinating. If you had one book that you would recommend on leadership, what would it be?
Ooh, I do like The Servant as Leader, which was Robert Greenleaf's pamphlet, but he's a little verbose.
Okay.
So it's only maybe 75 pages, but it's not like Proust level verbose, but it is a little bit.
Okay.
So there are some adaptations where people have taken his writings and then explained what it means. There's a couple books by Ed and Peter Schein. So Ed Schein is known for organizational culture and behavior. He did a ton of work in that space, and his son Peter, late in Ed's life, they worked together and they wrote a book about humble inquiry, and then later a follow-up, Humble Leadership. Both you can get on Audible, and I think they're about 5 hours to listen to.
Yeah.
So they're really approachable books.
I'm so into Audible right now.
Yeah.
Nonstop.
So if you need a recommendation on that and what to listen to, I recommend it. But basically he says in Humble Inquiry, though, like one wrong thing to do when somebody asks you a question is to give them advice. Like when they ask for advice, you should ask them another question, because you don't have enough information to give them proper advice. So I think that's kind of a good way to live too. But, I may think I know how to solve your problem, but without actually following up and probing deeper and inquiring, I might make an assumption of what I think is right for you.
Right. Right.
Which may not be accurate or useful.
Totally.
Yeah.
And obviously colored by your perception of the world and your experience.
Absolutely.
Tell me a little about your research, or what you researched before, what you're interested in, however you want to.
Sure. Yeah, so this week in particular, two of my papers have been kind of present for me, so maybe I'll talk about those.
Let's do it.
Let's start there. So something I published last year with my co-authors, Gordon Schmidt, Sai Islam, and Justine Phelps, was about the ASA model. So this is a really famous model in the human resources space. It's for attraction, selection, attrition. So it basically talks about how people come into an organization and then how they leave. It's this ecosystem of we attract them in by marketing our job, by telling them who we are. Maybe it's our branding, things like that. Could be part of our job ad. Then once they apply, we select the candidates that are our best fit. For the organization, for the role. And then naturally some attrit, they leave because either we've asked them to leave because they're not a good fit, or they leave for something else that may be a better fit for them. So we took that model and we looked at it specifically with gig workers. And we said, well, these gig workers sign up on an app, right? Maybe they just meet the bare requirements. Say they're driving for Uber. They have a clean driving record. They have a car. You know, there's certain age requirements, things like that. And then they're selected because they've met the minimum requirements. And then do they just attrit the same way? Do they leave the organization the same way? Because we do see some that will pause it for a while and then come back on when there may be surcharging or there may be opportunities to make better money. There may be some that are on multiple different apps. They're driving for Uber and for Lyft, or they're also on Fiverr, or they're whatever their skill set may be that they are using. But we also found that they were kind of organizing prior to leaving. So they were either on Reddit and talking about how to get the best gigs or what gigs paid the best. If they were doing surveys, for example, on Amazon Turk, they would give each other advice and help each other that way. But then we also saw some more formal organizations kind of trying to work with unions in other fields for rights of gig workers. Because a lot of times people get into gig work thinking that they can supplement their income or they can even make a living wage, and that doesn't always work out for them. So we proposed this new model, this ASOA, for the O for organizing. And we were able to publish that in the Journal of Managerial Psychology last year, which is published by Emerald. And so they just told us last week that they selected our paper for an Emerald Literati Award for outstanding paper.
That is awesome.
Yeah. Awesome. So for the journal. So I believe they pick one each year for each of their journals. And so we got chosen.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Raising the level of prestige on week two of the job. Fantastic.
Yeah. So that was really, really exciting. And I've always kind of said I was a good enough researcher. So now I guess I need to up that, say I'm an award-winning researcher, which is pretty exciting. I don't really do this for the awards, but I'm really proud that they saw the merits in the theory and what we created. I'm pretty proud of that paper. I think it's probably one of the best ones I've ever written. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Congrats.
Thank you. Thank you.
Actually, I'd love to read it.
Yeah, it's freely available for the next 12 months.
All right.
Depending on when you're listening to this. So you can find it on the internet and download it and read it. Yeah, so that's really exciting. And then we had a follow-up piece published just a couple of days ago on Monday. In First Monday, which
just,
is
just getting hits.
I
love it. Yes. All right.
Yeah. I was a little concerned nothing would hit this semester for my reappointment. And boy, have things gone well. So that's very exciting. But the follow-up piece tests our theory with gig workers looking at their social media. And we worked with a graduate student to kind of help us collect that data and analyze it. And I think it's an interesting piece. And we published it specifically with First Monday because they look at this computer human interaction.
Wow.
Yeah.
Completely random question for you.
Yeah.
Interviews for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
When I was at Deloitte before this, I was involved in recruiting. And you know, in my role here, I've done various capacities. I've been involved in the recruiting process, I suppose. I kind of feel like they don't matter. Now, explain to me what, I mean, because it's just like, hey, we're on our best behavior. This is going to be an hour, maybe a half hour. You know, I feel like references have been helpful historically. Mm-hmm. Do they matter? Do interviews matter? What's the research? What's your opinion on that? What's the...
Oh, yeah, they matter, but they're just, I think, one tool in the tool belt.
Okay.
So like you said, having references, although references are funny too, because you would hope that people would only put down people they have contacted and are going to say nice things about them. But I, as probably you have too, have gotten a call from someone before. And you're like, who are you talking about? Like a student from 5 years ago, who did not give me a heads up about this. And I have no idea what the position is and I don't know what to say. Right. And I'm clearly botching this for them. So yeah, maybe they are, you know, the references are more useful, but I think it's just one more piece of information. People can show up very differently in person than you would expect them to if you've only talked to them on the phone or on a Zoom. I think a lot of times people use an interview as, do I want to work with this person? Like, do I like this person? Or do I want to spend most of my workday with this
person? Right, right. Are they a good fit?
Are they a good fit? Yeah. And you hear that fit word used a lot. And, you know, personally, I don't like it because I feel like it's a vague way to say, like, I don't like you. But there can be a lot of usefulness to it if it's values driven and it's saying, I don't think you're going to last here long term, or I don't think you're going to be happy, and we would be doing a disservice to you to bring you into this position just to kick you to the curb later. So I think they can be useful, but it's in the design of the questions you ask.
Okay.
And how you go about it. You know, having been through a whole recruitment cycle to get here, I did 5 onsites and I got offers from all 5 institutions. And they're definitely, as a candidate, the way in which they structured it, the questions they asked me, the way that the faculty interacted with each other, it all told me about their culture and whether or not I wanted to be there or not.
That when we talk about fit, my concern with fit, and I know I was the one that said it. You know, if you're a white male from the South, hello Spokane, I'm gonna be like, "What's up?" You know, like, "Oh, you're a great fit," right? Like all the biases that can come with that, right? At the end of the day, it's maybe not be the best person for your.
You have a point about that. My contractor and I were talking about this the other day because I've been doing renovations on my little house, and I said to him, like, "How do you determine who you're gonna work with?"
Yeah.
You know, you met me and you were like, she seems normal enough. I guess I'll work with her. And he was like, honestly, when you called me and told me where your house was on the South Hill, I thought, oh, those are good people.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he hasn't met all our neighbors yet.
He hasn't met the cast of characters in our neighborhood. Houses with characters and houses with character. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love our neighborhood. It's got, I mean.
Me too. I do love it. So, yeah.
Good.
Yeah. But back to what you were saying about interviews and fit. I mean, I think I've said the word fit before. It is definitely something we look at. We look at person organization fit. We look at person job fit and person environment fit. So there's, you know, a lot of science to that, or a lot of research that's associated with fit. It's just sometimes we throw around terms like leadership. We throw it around when things aren't really leadership. Just label it leadership training. But we really training people, you know? Well, that's my only concern about that word, is sometimes how it gets used to.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
100%, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. As we have these conversations, I just realize how incompetent I am on so many fronts when it comes to this kind of stuff. No. I appreciate it. advice for grads, and I know you're kind of in a different position in that you're giving them a lot of golden nuggets of wisdom throughout their time here at GONZAGA. But what would you want, you know, you have let's fast forward 4 years.
Yeah.
Your first group of it, actually 5 years, but you don't have advisees yet, right? So you'll pick them up, I think maybe next year, not next semester, next year. What do you hope they take away from this place? How about that?
That's a really good question. I hope they have some skills that allow them, whether it's like concrete skills in their subject matter and they become experts, or at least have enough information to go into their entry-level jobs. But I also hope they have life skills, whether it comes to like the soft skills around like coping in difficult situations, how they treat other people. I think there's a lot of things that reinforce that on this campus, and a lot of faculty who lead with care. And so I would hope that they would take that into other organizations and make them kinder and more welcoming places.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I very much look forward to working with you more.
Thank you. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, awesome. Appreciate coming on. And yeah, I still owe you some coffee.
Okay.
All right.
This podcast has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business. It was edited by yours truly, Margie Allgaard. Go forth and set the world on fire. And go Zags.